Well, hi, everybody. Thank you for your comments and an email follow-up from our first seminar. Thanks for the kind words and for the questions and things that you'd like to be sure that we include. I will wrap those requests into our discussion so that it will flow into the segment that will most fit and have a context for that. Let me pause as we begin. Are there any comments or questions or responses from any of you before we move into our seminar for this evening? Any clarifications or questions from the last seminar? Well, again, thank you for your responses. I look forward to receiving any kind of feedback and to get better ideas about what will be most useful to each of you. So I'm going to go on lecture mode, and I'll reserve some time at the end for discussion so that if you have any questions, jot them down. Remember, I suggested that you write at the end of or any time during our discussion what your most important takeaway is so that you really capture that and see what's meaningful to you, the application for your coaching practice. Remember, the recordings will be posted by the next day on the site that you have, and the workbook and the questions or the outline and the workbook specifically are downloadable for you to follow along and make notes. If any of you have trouble locating that or relocating it, fire an email and I'll be happy to send it to you. So hold on, we're going to go to lecture mode and jot down any questions or clarifications you have. I want to be sure that we're discussing things that will. Yes, was there a question? Okay, I'll go on lecture mode so you don't have to manage the background noise. Okay, we discussed in our first seminar your money story and the concept of writing a new money story. And remember, as we talked just briefly, this is our working concept, our metaphor as coaches. Our clients aren't telling you their story. They're telling you the way it is. They're telling you their experience. It's not a story for them. This is simply our way of looking at, organizing, and conceptualizing to hopefully make useful a way to go about and organize the process of coaching. So we're going to look more closely at the aspects of writing a new money story and how to do that, at the principles and practice of change step by step. We're going to examine the essential steps of change to create a new and evolving story or simply revise an existing story if it doesn't work as well, so that it can be successful and fulfilling. Now, the system that I want to discuss with you, it's a macro system. You've heard me say, if you want to change, focus on the system, not just the goal. The system is what we bring as coaches that can be unique, and it is certainly antithetical to a consultancy where somebody presents a problem and then you go about solving the problem. This is a collaborative effort to look at and develop a more effective experience and story. So the roadmap is simply the acronym of the seven steps to deconstruct and understand an existing story for us as coaches. And it's not something that's an exercise that a client will do. This is simply a way that it's one way to conceptualize the algorithms and the meanings and the ways that our minds, brains, and behaviors and emotion process what's going on. So this is simply a way to understand, to see what needs to be changed and or how to develop and evolve a new or different way of doing things. So here are the, and we're going to spend the remainder of our time together really understanding a systematic way to work with your clients. So here is a brief overview, and this is in your outline, a brief overview of the roadmap for a new money story. Recognize authorship. You're writing your money story from assumptions to every choice that you make about money, earning, spending, saving. Own your story. Accountability is prerequisite to change. Assess the plot and the storylines. This is to recognize the behaviors, the hidden messages, the elusive language of mind and emotion. This is so much of the 90 to 95% of our operating system and our clients' operating system that's not logical and conscious and intellectual. This is what we're listening for to see what's really happening and then collaboratively listening with the client to do this. Then to decide what to change, to make informed choices about what you keep, what you let go, what you change, what you enhance. Map changes, goals and success strategies. Author new experiences. Create the new money story you desire. And then, very importantly, to program new identity, because this is what makes change permanent. We're going to return to this. Incorporate and sustain the changes with a corresponding, a transformation of the model that we use, including how we see ourselves. So in this seminar, we're going to discuss the first three steps of the roadmap. Again, simply ways to inform your listening to the exchange you have with your client. So the first step is for the client to recognize authorship of a money story. I'm going to keep it in a language to talk to you so that you're addressing this yourself. As you understand your story, you're going to be in the best place to help a client understand their story. So it's recognition of authorship of your money story. Now, remember this premise. Every moment, we actively construct what we think and feel and experience. Each is a choice. Whatever we experience, we either accept or create. It's a simply different way of seeing it. But so often, the story that's closest to us, our own, is the most difficult to know because, again, for the client, it seems like that's just the way things are. So how can you tell your money story to yourself to know what to keep, what to change, what to enhance? Here are four principles to recognize authorship. This is an important backdrop in working with your clients to help them understand that it's not there until they create it. And every day is a blank page. Now, it's a given that there's a whole lot of noise in the background from this unconscious operating system, but the choice of what to think, feel, act, do, that's the client. So, first principle, our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions, and our beliefs write the software of our behavior. We see what we believe, and we're always right because we write the story. Here's an illustration of that. This is out of London a number of years ago, Oxford. Two anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, essentially identical ape colonies to live and observe for a year. They had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, training, education, and they expected significant similarities in these, and we're going to study the nuances. But when the two anthropologists emerged to compare notes, they found remarkable discrepancies. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes. He was integrated into the colony, achieved a real intimacy and unity, a comfort with the ape colony. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of the colony, of his colony. He remained careful and vigilant. He always seemed right on the cusp of a conflict, never reached that harmony. The anthropologist could not understand the discrepant results or find any reasons. They and their teams puzzled over this for months until they finally found one difference. The anthropologist who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider had a gun. Now, his gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it. But he knew he had it. He knew that if things got tough, he had an out. The anthropologist who had no gun instead had a commitment. He knew from the beginning that he would either make it or not on his own. And in retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced. We tell our story, and then our story tells us. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. With the same belief, you'll continue to have the same results. If you change your belief, you can have different results. This is one of those things that we listen for in the process of how our clients are telling their story. This is also why you'll never have to go back into the history or ask why questions or look at the origins or the nuances of problems, because everything that is important in a current story, every algorithm that's operative for that client will ultimately emerge, be activated in the relationship with you. So you'll hear in the process exactly the assumptions, the beliefs, the things that work and don't work, and listening carefully for things that are not as much in conscious focus for the client, like hidden assumptions, such as, you know, I really need to get confident before I can offer my services, or I have to be comfortable to launch my website. Limiting assumptions, unconscious beliefs, various things that can interfere with a process, you'll begin to hear as you listen carefully in your coaching. Second principle, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. Our beliefs become our reality, and even some things you have to believe in order to see. Our possibilities are always a manifestation of what we allow ourselves to consider. A story can even define possibility. And you guys know this story. In centuries of recorded time, no one ran the mile in under 4 minutes. It was considered physiologically impossible that if someone ever did it, they would die. Then, in 1953, Dr. Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile in 1954. Within the following 12 months, over a dozen other runners broke the 4-minute mile as well. The obstacle of the impossible could no longer be constructed. Today, this is commonplace. When the mindset of what's possible changes, reality then changes as well. In fact, when Bannister crossed the finish line, he actually collapsed. Someone gave him smelling salts. The first thing he said, he asked, "Did I die?" He considered the beliefs that were accepted at the time that he must have died because he broke the 4-minute mile. The beliefs within us, our map of reality, determine what we perceive, including what and how we select and register and process. We construct our storylines from these premises. we have to bring our beliefs about money, finances, and wealth into conscious focus to assess how well they work in present time. Here's an illustration. Money was elusive for this family with 7 children, and they often struggled even to have enough food. They were proud that they had never gone on relief, as welfare was called at that time. This required the father to be away for several months at a time to work in other states. Finally, after years of being exhausted and tired, the mother agreed to accept relief. Around this time, she had also bartered canning vegetables for almost 3 years to have enough money to have her home painted. Someone in the welfare agency passed by and saw her freshly painted house. He called her and wondered, since she could afford to have her home painted, did they really need to be on relief? And this very proud woman said, "Just take it back. I don't want it anymore." For this family, money you didn't earn had strings attached. Their experience of the scarcity of money became a legacy amalgamating some of their life stories. 3 generations later, her granddaughter was going through a post-divorce move and adjustment with a difficult financial time supporting her 2 children, but she was adamant about not asking for anything. She was determined, quote, not to become one of those people who took welfare, end of quote. She carried the same torch of pride as her grandmother. She even said, "One of my children refused to eat the free lunch that she was offered at school because choices were limited." Her great-grandmother learned that you gave up certain freedoms with a free lunch. And this is what we now know in even more indirect ways as epigenetic experiences and ways of transmitting things other than on genes themselves, but how our beliefs and behaviors change gene expression. The choices we make as parents are models that our children often emulate. They look, experience, and they take unconscious notes while we're talking about other things. And these notes get passed on. We know that so many beliefs and behavioral patterns are downloaded in the early years of life, even without conscious recognition. For example, think about how you came to see what money meant to your parents, what it meant to them. Think about the first word you wrote when I asked you to write down 1 word about what money means to you. Think about how this may have influenced the beliefs you have in seeing what your parents thought and felt about money, what they did with it, how they regarded people who had more or who had less, and how they saw the various ways of interacting with you and the models they created, not just by the interaction with you, but by you viewing what they did, how they saw, how they felt, and how it affected the behavior. Principle 3, a new money story can only occur by living in the present moment. Social scientists discovered that when you measure people's present intentions, you can affect their future behavior. When people are asked what they intend to do, they're more likely to act according to how they respond, because once someone commits to something out loud, they're more likely to follow through. When you ask people the day before an election if they intend to vote, it increases the probability of their going to vote by 25%. A study of 40,000 people asked, "Do you intend to buy a new car?" The question increased purchase rates in the next 3 months by 35%. Other behaviors with increased frequency: asking if people intend to eat certain foods, to exercise, to regularly fund retirement funds. Here's a study that some of you have heard me mention. in a number of large physician practices. The usual practice for half of the people, and they did this as much as they could, a control study, for half of the patients, they did the usual. The receptionist would write the time and the date on the card, and this is pre-Zoom, okay, pre-pandemic study. And the other half, they gave the card to the patient and asked the patient to write the date and the time of the follow-up appointment. When the patient wrote it, they had 18% less no-show. They committed to themselves, even silently, by writing it down, and they were more likely to follow through. Principle 4, our minds seek closure and infer causality, whether it's accurate or not. Now, here's an illustration of why questions don't really work that well, because someone is going to automatically bring closure by finding an answer, by creating an answer to the why question, even if it doesn't fit, even if it's not causal. A number of studies, a series done by Dr. Dan Gilbert at Harvard, showed volunteers words appearing on a computer screen for a few milliseconds. It was 1/50th of a second, and this was subliminal programming, basically. This was such a short time, they were unaware the words were shown. They could not pick them out guessing from a multiple choice. But yet, the word that flashed influenced subsequent behavior. For example, when the word hostile was flashed, volunteers judged others slightly more negatively. When the word elderly was flashed, volunteers walked just a bit more slowly. When the word stupid was flashed, they would perform slightly less well on tests. Now, these volunteers were later asked why they judged or walked or scored the way they did. None of them said, "I don't know." And they quickly considered the facts that they were given, that they performed, they were shown videos of that or scores. They were not aware of this, but then they came up with some reason, like, well, I was jet-lagged, or I've been having difficulty sleeping. And they denied the data that they saw on the screen or on the paper that said they performed less well, except to deny it and say, I was just a little bit off. I was just tired when I took the test. Each was unaware of the fact that they were falsely attributing cause and effect. So these findings show the desire we have to bring closure for our brains to end any dissonance by imposing certainty, for our minds to create a complete story by a causal explanation that infers closure and a sense of effectiveness. This is why, for example, in a very practical way, remember the difficulty, and for me it's still there, when you began working with clients to not simply tell them the best way to do this, to not offer a suggestion, to not give advice, to not let them know what they really need to do. Both the client and the coach want you to give a suggestion or give advice, not because it's going to be right, not because they're going to follow it, but because it brings closure. So there's not any dissonance, any hint of discomfort with the client for exploring something new and different and taking a step into the unknown. And the coach also feels effective by superimposing our own suggestion, and we don't have to keep it open anymore. So that's something I think is important for us to keep in mind. So this is why we rationalize or justify or do any number of other mental gymnastics that bring closure without ownership or growth, to foreclose possibilities rather than to open possibilities. It's a finish without an ending. And this also is how confidence and clarity create an experience of trust in the listener. We collaboratively explore together. Now, here's an application of this very principle. A scam artist can create a cult-like following by offering an evocative promise that touches someone's vague, hazy dreams to crystallize it and make it appear vividly in reach. Think about how you can buy hope for a dollar for a lottery ticket. The picture painted by the scam artist allows someone to project what they want to see. It becomes a Rorschach, and they project their hope, their dancing ideas, if it's of money. People project their desires onto a promising story that crystallizes a fantasy like of magical wealth. The scam artist is half of the co-creative story of the scam. The victim completes the other half. Now, I'd suggest you do the four exercises of step one to be sure you get the foundation of really recognizing your money story and your authorship of it. And remember these basic ideas, this is just for us again, of any story. The plot, this is our core theme and story, themes and storylines of money stories that inform what we look for, how we attribute meaning to what we actually see. And the storylines, the money story is your self-statement. Every time you make, use, or save money, you're making a self-statement. And we'll come back to that concept. Step two, own your money story. Recognize it as a first step that you're creating it, and then to own it. Now, this may not sound so different, but I'd suggest just to crystallize this awareness for you. Review, or actually do the exercise, the work tool of assumptions and motivations that construct storylines. This is the exercise on page, I think it's 2.5 of your workbook. So here's the principle. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our beliefs determine what we see and then how we process it. This is our software package. Adding more information to the million bits of data that we process daily, like a new diet, a health club membership, will likely not have an impact unless you change the software, unless you change your operating system. So here's a way to think about working with yourself, working with a client, to examine how a storyline is constructed. Here's an equation that might be helpful. This is in your outline. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. So if you hear your client being unhappy with or seeing a compromise in performance, look at the antecedent. What is the behavior that generates that performance or that compromise? If the behavior is not working or not optimal, then look at the antecedent for that, the beliefs. Remember, beliefs are the software that determine behavior. So look at what the beliefs are, and we'll come back to that in more specific ways. So here are some examples, and we'll see this in the workbook, of empowering beliefs. And these are things mostly you'd be listening for, because someone may not just say, okay, this is my belief, even though it's not working. Here's some empowering beliefs. I can make the money I need. I will find a way to love my work. I will be fully dedicated to optimum performance. Some limiting beliefs that also influence reality and behavior. And limiting effects can have an effect emotionally and physically. So this is also why after every one of these, hear me interrupting a client to look carefully at this, because if it's a limiting belief, I don't want to wait till the end of three paragraphs to go back. I want for us to examine it at that moment. Some limiting beliefs. I can't find time to exercise. I don't have enough experience. I don't make enough to save anything. And now notice these examples are a variety of responses, behaviors, reaction, even complex patterns. Our imagination is limitless in its ability to create scenarios of disaster or of success. But first you have to recognize each experience as a choice instead of, well, this is just the way things are. So a fundamental precept of step two, own your story, is a repetition here of what I said moments ago. Whatever you experience, you either create or accept. That's ownership of a story. And some stories are perpetuated outside awareness, which is also where we come in as mentor coaches. So I want to apply that notion by talking about two aspects of a story. And these are simply ways to listen to a client. Point of reference and active versus passive position. These are things that a client will tell you while they're talking about other things. And I just want to highlight these to not miss these very important assumptions that may be constructing a story to create its success or its compromise. And consider for yourself these two sets of ideas that I'm about to talk about, especially if you do the exercises. Can you make and enjoy money and money myths? These are both in the workbook. So first, point of reference. As you listen to a client, think about how what their point of reference is. A point of reference is a basic component of story writing. People who don't own their stories have a premise of an external point of reference that can result in resignation or passivity, or just the experience of helplessness. They may transfer responsibility to someone or something outside themselves. They may react to situations they're in rather than proactively planning. So here are some characteristics, some examples of someone speaking with an external point of reference. They may feel as if they have little or no control over things. Life is just happening to be reacted to. Well, there's nothing I can do. Consider each of these as a coachable moment, something that we can actively address or highlight with a client. They may feel vulnerable to the responses of others. Their language can even absolve them of responsibility. She makes me so mad. They may focus on responding rather than creating. Well, I have to do this. Or they may see themselves as unchanging. That's just the way I am. They may believe they can only change things by changing the outside person or process. If they experience a symptom in their body, they may medicate it away. That's like seeing a warning light, the dash of your car, and turning off the bulb. Disconnecting, if you get past a 1950 car, rather than pursuing the problem. Those with an internal point of reference see their authority as their own. This is what we're coaching toward. Their premise is acceptance of responsibility, and the experience is of effectiveness. They know or they learn that they write their own story, every component of that story. And here's how that can sound. Again, this is what we coach toward. They recognize accountability for each aspect of what they do. They're proactive. They plan. They look around the corner. If they experience an unpleasant result, they examine the chain of events that generated that result, then look for alternatives. In coaching, we frame this perhaps as, rather than looking at and understanding a problem, what's the possibility or the opportunity here? A different mindset They decide what to change and initiate that change and realize, often with our gentle nudging, that the menu of choices is also created. You can choose, and you can choose how you choose. Now, related to that, and this is something that we can listen for and learn a great deal about our client, especially as they see themselves vis-a-vis their own authority. And that can simply come out in active versus passive positions. Let me give you some examples. Sometimes the story just seems to write itself, to just happen. Well, I ran out of time, so it couldn't work out. Can't seem to put money into savings. This just seems to keep happening. Each of these are coachable moments because they reflect a passive position, as if what they are doing is acting upon them rather than that they're the creator of it. Their story can even become an identity. I'm a risk taker. I'm a bargain hunter. Or a simple example is that someone will generate a feeling, not be as aware that they're generating it, but feel like that feeling is then acting on them. My doubt paralyzed me. My anxiety stopped me. Review the exercise when you have time under step 2. 17 common money storylines. Examine the storylines as objectively as possible, not to judge or criticize yourself, but simply to inform. So, with these first two steps then, once recognizing and owning your money story, step 3 is to assess the plot and storylines of your money story. So, a belief or a fact is an anatomical reality in your brain. It's a physical part of a neuronal network. And what we come to see and know as coaches is we can't present a simple explanation or give advice or give information and remove an existing neural network or existing belief. We can't remove any anatomical reality in that client's brain just by listing a reason that it ought to work better if you follow my advice or giving information. Or expect that presenting a new fact is going to overwrite the one that's already there. But change can occur. It's a process, not an event. This step to assess your money story, and remember, this is interchangeable with any other story. If you're focusing on wellness, if you're focusing on career, if you're focusing on someone's life story or relationship, we're just focusing on money here. These are the essential steps in looking at this system as one way of understanding the algorithms that someone's operating on and looking at how to revise or create new ones. So this step to assess the money plot and storylines includes examining beliefs and assumptions to see if they're working, to see if they're optimal or if they're limiting, or especially to try out other beliefs. What's another way to look at this? Is there any way that how you're looking at it can be limiting? Who may have a different perspective than yours? Are there any questions you're afraid to ask? What do you really want? What do you most need to let go of or to change? Now, here's something I think is really important. This is one of the things, this is really the only kind of exercise or request I might have of a new client, other than filling in the client information packet to give us both a better idea of the scope and what they want to do, is to ask them to look at the needs and ideals exercise. You can see this for yourself. It may be helpful, and see if it's helpful to you to do this. It begins on page 3.5 of the workbook. Ideals and needs are at the core of identity, part of the foundation of your sense of self. They're both essential to know when you want to begin to focus on a process of change to align your needs and ideals with the strategies and goals that you have so that all of you is going in the same direction. I think you'll see a case illustration in that part of the workbook of someone whose strategies and goals were at odds with their basic needs and ideals. But again, ideals are basically our values, our internal standards of excellence. They're a personal model of an internal guide to purpose. Living up to personal, attainable ideals generates a sense of worth and esteem. This is, in fact, the only place that I know self-esteem comes from, is from having attainable ideals and living up to it. If self-esteem comes from any other place, it would have a different first name. And failure to live up to an internal ideal results in a feeling of shame. Guilt is about transgression. Shame is about having an ideal and not living up to it. Needs now, as you'll see, are an essential requirement, a necessity for mind, body, and spirit. Unmet, frustrated needs can create discomfort. A need may be most obvious when it's not met. So you can get sick if you don't have enough of a need. You can get sick if you have too much of a want. And you can never get enough of what you don't need. So look at those exercises and pick the top three needs, or insert other ones if that list is not inclusive, and the top three ideals. That can help you inform plans going forward. Remember, we touched a little bit last time on comfort zones. We did the thumb exercise. A comfort zone is simply a part of our default mode. Once we do something enough, our brain hardwires it so that it's a gradual process, but once established, it resists change. A comfort zone, think of it like a home thermostat. If it changes 1 or 2 degrees, boom, it's automatic to activate to get back to that set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and brains both contribute to this. We even have, for example, a comfort zone with our weight. We return to the familiar even when we don't like it or when it's uncomfortable. And think about how subtle a comfort zone can be in determining choices. What you eat, the difficulty of starting a new exercise program, or a savings program. A comfort zone can be repeated roles you play in a relationship, or the procrastination of lifestyle changes that you need to make, or simply establishing a structured savings plan. So here's another example of a comfort zone in action. Most lottery winners manage to plan or give away, to suspend or give away their newfound winnings to return to their previous situation. Just over 80% of lottery winners in the United States of $3 million or more file bankruptcy within the first 5 years. Their money changed, but their mindsets didn't. So much money moved them from their comfort zone, they ended up returning to it. Think about how if somebody does procrastination and really does it well, working under pressure, then waiting until the last minute, creating crisis, this can be a comfort zone. Someone can become habituated to the adrenaline and cortisol rush of waiting until the last minute, finishing in a flourish, being excited, and then being relieved, so much so that they repeat it. Here's another simple example. A simple Irish woman lived an ordinary life in a small village for over 4.5 decades. Then suddenly, Susan Boyle vaulted onto the world stage with Britain's Got Talent. One of the initial results is that she became overwhelmed and had to be hospitalized the day after her final completion and success. She, like the lottery winners, wasn't motivated to sabotage herself, but got on overload way beyond her comfort zone and simply returned to her comfort zone because she didn't have any models, internal models of how to deal with this unprecedented situation. In the beginning, departure from a comfort zone feels by definition uncomfortable. It's a rupture of continuity. A routine is broken. This is where we come in as coaches. Sometimes letting go of a comfort zone occurs only when the pain's too great to remain in it, or with the recognition that it doesn't work and there may be something better. And remember, a habit is not a definition. It's a choice that gets repeated. The choices we tend to make and that you'll be listening for with your clients may come from the comfort zone for that person. But a comfort zone can trade passion for predictability, maybe creativity for continuity, and the new for the familiar. So this is where we collaboratively help our client consider and create a way of moving beyond their comfort zone step by planned step. A comfort zone is an unconscious thermostat until it becomes conscious. Then you can reprogram your mind and brain. Part of the assessment of your money story is to understand conflicted and contradictory storylines. When you feel with one part of the brain and plan with another, you need a map. A paradigm, also called a mindset, is a model. It's a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. So, with the right map, and remember, the paradigm is the map that explains the territory, not the territory itself. With the right map, planning and strategy can make a huge difference. So, we each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. We're often not aware of having them, but we just assume that we see things the way they are. So here's one application in coaching. We've touched on this, but I want to return to revisit this and consider something that every one of you, in your experience and with every client, you will see this in a repeated way. Whenever there's a step into a new territory, an unknown and unprecedented experience, even a simple check, a simple step of change, this will register with your client as an uncertainty because it's a step into the new and unknown. They move beyond their default mode. When you work with a client to do that, you're breaking the script that the client has, this default mode that's on autopilot, even if it's simply a step. And remember, that will activate the error detection mechanism of the brain. So this is something that to keep in mind, to really collaboratively help your client understand this discomfort and to frame it perhaps as an indication that they're moving ahead, a signpost that they're beyond where they've been before. In other words, as progress and possibility, rather than misinterpreting it, for example, as if this discomfort is my gut telling me I'm wrong, this is a bad choice, or my intuition is telling me that this is not the right way to go. So to perceive that, even though it's subtle, and to interpret it correctly, are both really important as someone goes ahead to read an anxiety or uncertainty of a new experience, not in an old paradigm like anxiety equals danger ahead or uncertainty means wrong decision and it makes sense to stop, but to create, to co-create a current paradigm that can reframe the excitement and trepidation as a step of progress. So, another thing just to consider, sometimes we're afraid of the wrong things. We fear what's more easily remembered, or we fear what we can't control. It's far more dangerous to be behind the wheel of a car, but in airplane seat 18C, we feel no control. It's an availability bias, a prediction based on greater emotional charge. are smokers who are afraid of flying. Average across all participants, smoking shortens their lives by 5 years. Average across all participants, flying shortens their lives by 1 day. So, are you afraid enough of not having abundance in later years to plan and save sufficiently for it now? The guy in the previous decade at Money Magazine, called the greatest living investor, said the most common money mistake that people make is extrapolation, to believe that things will always be the same in the future as they are now, or that we can superimpose a current model and information onto the future. So then this means we need to assess our money stories in some important ways. And this is the assessment part, to monitor our choices, to question our ideas, to probe our reasoning, and maybe just to ask clearly and honestly, does it work? Remember, we're always reaching our goals, whether they're conscious or unconscious. So it's important to be really clear about what exactly our goals are. Here's a simple example. If you want to change your body, begin with changing your body image. Visualize a specific image you want to achieve, your ideal body image, your true body self, not a false self like overweight or out of shape or wanting to be like somebody else, because your body is the projection of your mind's software. So is your savings account. And because people don't change their body image is why those people will gain back the weight they've lost, plus maybe 2 or 3 pounds. And they haven't changed, they've changed their weight, but they haven't changed their body image. Also, look at your money story. Listen to the language in regard to your goals. If you say you're going to try, you may be building an out. You know the words of somebody not committed, and this is what you'll be asking for at the end, or what you do already ask for at the end of a coaching session. Based on this, what do you commit to do in the next week? So you know the words of somebody not committed. I'll try, I should, I ought to, I know I need to. These build in a takeaway. When someone says, I'm going to try to stop drinking, you know they're going to keep drinking. Here are the words of someone committed. I will. So here's something to consider about looking at existing beliefs and creating a new belief. Here's a brief story to illustrate how the value we attribute, the belief, can change how we perceive something. Nathan Handworker, you know this better be a good story with a name like that, put in a new food stand on Coney Island. Handworker's hot dogs were pure beef, made from his wife's recipe, every bit as delicious as his competitors, most thought a bit more so. But he priced his at 5 cents, and the other hot dogs were priced at 10 cents. You can tell how long ago this was. And this is also a story for those of you who are having any question or doubt or are undercharging for your professional services. That's the sidebar here. Handworker attracted no customers. His people wondered if his hot dogs were inferior and attributed poor quality ingredients to his product. His sales were not helped when he offered free root beer and free pickle. That just validated that the hot dogs must be worth even less because he's trying to give away all this stuff. These free products furthered the perception that it was substandard. Then Handworker came up with a new ploy. He asked doctors from a nearby hospital to stand around eating his hot dogs while they were wearing their white coats and stethoscopes. And he raised his prices significantly. His hot dogs started selling. People assumed that if physicians were eating his food and it cost at least twice as much as his competitors, it had to be good. So Nathan's Famous Hot Dogs began selling well. And well into this century, they're still nationally available. Creating a new belief is not an instantaneous thing. It's a process. It can take some period of time. But it takes however long it takes. It's your process, not anyone else's. So don't compare your inside to someone else's outside, or your journey or your timetable to someone else. It's uniquely yours. You will hear something that's important, and I have said this to clients who contemplate this question. You will always know the difference between avoiding and procrastinating from dosing, timing, and titrating. One is a process of your own pace. The other is simply procrastinating or avoiding. In changing your belief and the result of the change in your action, you're also changing your mind and your brain. The choices you make generate the moment-by-moment life you live. When you change your belief, you're also changing your mind and your brain when you put this into action in your behavior. At any moment in time, neural networks are influenced by three factors: genes, experiences, and focused attention. Regardless of someone's unique brain architecture and individual complexity, these three factors intersect in any moment, in any nanosecond. Genes, experiences, focused attention. What we deal with in coaching is focused attention and developing a system to implement that. Now, here's the backstory. DNA downloads its information from expression of its code. We now know that it goes in the other direction. For many of our experiences and for most of our beliefs, most of the genes that determine our beliefs and action, beliefs can turn genes on and off to determine the major extent of the expression of DNA-based information. That's how powerful a new story can be. And here's a final thought, and I want to open it up for clarification, question, discussion. Here's a final thought. What remains unconscious will likely be attributed to fate. So we're in conversation mode now. If you'll manage the background noise, I'm interested in your questions or clarification. To elaborate just a second on the we attribute to fate, we began to think about what we do when we began to listen to the process. So this is what we do as coaches. This is how we listen for what determines the major part of someone's story, to listen to the beliefs and assumptions they're operating on that generate their conscious focus. And we can look at, there's some information in the handout, actually in the workbook, about different kinds of assumptions that can bias or influence money stories. And I'd suggest you look at those, and if there are any questions, we don't have time fully to go over those, but if you have thoughts or questions about any of those, that's simply to inform your listening along the principles of these first three steps of the roadmap that we've talked about today. So any clarifications or questions that you have? Or thoughts from hearing this? So simply, the roadmap is one system to use. You'll see as we move into it a bit more, it's six steps of change and one process of transformation, and we'll get to that. So whatever storylines of money, wellness, career, relationship, or other specific component, like a way to listen to biases or beliefs or blind spots, It's simply a way to inform our listening, to help us listen better and understand what we're hearing, to collaboratively get our client to understand and look together at whatever may be limiting, as well as what may be enhancing. And the simplest way that we talk about coaching is, if it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. So any questions or clarifications about anything that we've talked about before we wrap up? If you have anything, and as if you listen to this or reflect on it and something comes up, or if you do some of the exercises yourself to get a better idea, fire off an email. If there's anything you feel would be helpful for us to discuss as a group, let me know, or mention it next time as we began. And I hear from some of you, you'd like a little bit more of case illustration. I will wrap that in more so in our third and fourth seminar. So that's a promise to come of illustrating this with cases and examples a bit more to make it even more practical. But I would say also, do some of the exercises and work tools. You don't have to go through those in a sequence, but pick one or two that kind of says something to you. See if it's helpful to think about it systematically and see if it fits into the particular step of the acronym roadmap that you're on. So we'll pick up right here next time. Let me know if there's anything you think of later, or those of you who listen to the recording, I'll be happy to address it. So I look forward to picking up with you next time right here. Thanks very much again for your responses and the kind words. Till next week. Bye now. Take good care of yourselves.